Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Beyond the applications of simple arithmetic, mathematics quickly became almost impenetrable to me. A low mumbling of occasionally familiar words and numerical spaghetti. I was curious, in that little boy way, about engines and rockets and planets and stars, but was convinced that the world of science would be closed off to me. Most explanations held me in a kind of mental paralysis before I could even begin to understand them. About 10 years ago, I picked up a copy of Michael Frayen's play, Copenhagen. Perhaps history, my favourite subject, could provide a way into the indecipherable language of science. Written in 1988, the play concerns the meeting of two great nuclear physicists in the Danish capital in 1941. Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg had worked on the same programme before the war, but now found themselves on different sides. The purpose of the meeting is the subject of much speculation. Heisenberg, in charge of nuclear development for Hitler, claimed that he was deliberately holding back the programme for fear of the unimaginable consequences of a Nazi nuclear weapon. Niels Bohr was certain, however, that his counterpart was simply trying to establish how far the Allied programme had advanced. Copenhagen opened up the world of physics to me. Given my second attempt at maths O level had ended in a U for unclassified, this was not unremarkable. My first effort had scored a D, the equivalent of hitting the crossbar, but that was a fluke. My fascination with subatomic particle physics grew. I read a book called The Trouble with Physics by Lee Smolin, a famous particle physicist, the perfect layman's guide to current thinking on this subject. The trouble of its title is that physics has not had a unified theory for some 50 years. In very simple terms, Einstein's general theory of relativity and quantum physics do not gel. The former describes the universe as a continuum, the latter as packets or quanta of energy. The physics of big things does not apply to the universe of its tiniest particles. Einstein had a great difficulty with a particular theory of quantum physics called entanglement, which describes how particles behave in symmetry, regardless of how far apart they are. He famously described it as spooky action at a distance. Perhaps the single most intriguing experiment that best proves the existence of quantum physics is the double slit experiment, first performed in 1801. Here, a single photon of light is passed through a slit and is detected as a single mark on a backboard. A second photon is fired through a parallel slit simultaneously, but this time several marks appear on the backboard. It appears that the light behaves both as a particle and a wave simultaneously. Stranger still, if you attempt to observe the moment the particles change their state, only two single marks appear. Enter the mysterious universe of Heisenberg's chaos theory and Schrödinger's cat. Two conditions appear to happen simultaneously. Practical applications of quantum mechanics have been used for some 20 years with GPS, and we are at the dawn of the quantum computer. Put another way, we are learning a new vocabulary to describe the very act of observation. My wife's brother is an astrophysicist. It's the only job spec I know that can be described by reciting the lyrics to Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. The song's musical arrangement is attributed to Mozart in 1761, when he was 5. It's reassuringly authentic as a nursery rhyme, given the infancy of its composer. The lyrics, however, did not arrive until Jane Taylor published them in 1806. My brother-in-law works with a team that builds telescopes in Chile and Namibia. They discovered an entire galaxy. I peep into his realm. However, it was Lee Smolin who introduced me to the Standard Model, which comprises the four forces in the universe: strong and weak nuclear forces, electromagnetism, and gravity. A whole galaxy of subatomic particles, including quarks, leptons, neutrinos, and bosons. The most famous of these, the Higgs boson, was identified in an experiment at CERN in Geneva in 2012. Light particles were accelerated close to the speed of light around a 27-kilometer ring of magnets in opposite directions by a machine called the Large Hadron Collider. The resulting collision allowed detectors to identify the particle whose existence Professor Higgs had predicted in 1964. Dubbed the God particle, this is the particle that Higgs believes gives mass to all other particles. Without it, no solid state could exist. I've learned about black holes, celestial bodies so dense that they trap everything in their orbit, including light. The point of no return is called the event horizon, that moment on the Niagara River where no amount of effort will save you from a precipitous end. And I've watched footage of a black hole devouring a star, the first time such a moment has been observed and recorded. I've tried to understand supersymmetry, entanglement, and string theory, the last of which is where much of the consensus lies as physicists search for a unifying theory. But my lack of basic maths quickly catches up with me, and I'm soon forced to cool the synapses. I am relieved to have found a bus that has taken me a few stops past the Flat Earth Society and a moon made of cheese. Maths alone cannot describe a universe where some stars are lucky and others twinkle. Some theorize that the human brain is the most mysterious organism in the entire universe. Perhaps I should be satisfied with that.
As Galway enters the spotlight as the 2020 Cultural Capital of Europe, my mind is drawn back to March 1991 and the day a friend and I gatecrashed the official launch of Dublin as the European City of Culture at the National Concert Hall. I had adored the band Hallé's Flowers since their song Don't Go had taken over the Irish airwaves a few years before. My homework journal and bedroom walls were plastered in posters of the band, and as well as shop-bought records, I had stacks of bootleg cassettes and video recordings. I joined their fan club and talked about them non-stop to anyone who would listen. I was so obsessed with them that one winter, screeching cat-like sounds reverberated through my house as I attempted to teach myself the tin whistle, just so I could play along with the Hallé's Flowers version of She the Wamoy. To my family's relief, I quickly realised my musical prowess was confined to turning on and off the stereo. My dream was to interview the band for my school magazine. But how? I was a teenager without any media contacts. This was long before social media would allow easy interaction between musicians and their fans. But I was a voracious reader of newspapers, which is how I found out that the Hallé's Flowers were to play at the City of Culture event. I decided to write to the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Michael Donnelly, to ask if I, as the band's biggest fan, could attend along with the invited councillors. I checked the post every morning. Nothing. But I was young and determined. On the morning of the event, myself and my friend Sorsha headed in early to town, where celebrations were underway to mark the designation, including the release of 1,991 balloons into the sky at St. Stephen's Green. It was a Saturday morning, so there was a large crowd looking on as the Lord Mayor made his way in style from the Mansion House to the concert hall in the ornate Lord Mayor's carriage. We followed him on foot, then stood awkwardly outside the railings, hoping to spot one of the band members going in. The Taoiseach Charles Haughey arrived, as did several European cultural ministers. This was a proper official do, so it was starting to look unlikely we would get anywhere near the band. But when one of the city councillors came out to have a smoke, we got chatting and quizzed him on what was going on, What's it like in there? We asked. Have the hothouse flowers played yet? Did you see them? Maybe he was impressed with our devotion to the band. Or maybe he just felt sorry for us as we shivered in the cold. But right away he said, come on, I'll get you in. There are loads of spare seats. He ushered us inside, then pointed at the side of the stage. See over there, he said. When the event is over, you go through that door and that's where the band will be. Best of luck. We were in. The salute to Dublin ceremony was beautiful and finished with a wonderful performance of Christchurch Bells and The Older We Get by Hothouse Flowers. We then brazenly followed our friendly counsellor's instructions and found ourselves in a backstage area chatting to the band's bass player, Peter O'Toole. He loved our story of how we managed to get in to see them. He gave me the number of the place they rehearsed and told me to give him a ring to organise a day and a time for the interview. It was that easy. And so a few weeks later, we turned up at the factory rehearsal studio near the Grand Canal. When we got inside, the group's saxophone player, Leo Barnes, was the only member of the band there. And even though he knew nothing about it, he kindly agreed to be interviewed by me. The others arrived a little later. We were quite starstruck. Saoirse was hardly able to speak. But over tea and biscuits, they put us at ease and answered all my questions with good humour and patience. Fiacna mentioned his newborn twins were keeping him up at night, yet his tiredness didn't show. Leo said he didn't have many good memories of his school days, which he spent in an orphanage in Kilkenny, although he did enjoy playing hurling. Peter told me he left school early and got a job delivering bread, which left him the afternoon free to hang around with his friends in St. Stephen's Green. Before we finished, Lee mentioned that the original name for the band had been Goose Stomp 75. We said we'd open a book on a certain page, he explained. The page was 75 and had the word Goose Stomp written on it. The world was nearly saved from all those flower-related headlines, blossoming and wilting and so on. Then they brought us into their studio and played us two new songs from their next album, a world exclusive. They also had fun looking through my scrapbook of newspaper cuttings about them that I had collated over the previous 3 years. It felt like a dream to me. They were at that time considered the biggest band in Ireland after U2. And yet they gave us, a couple of ordinary teenagers, 2 hours out of their busy schedule for my school magazine article, as if we were well-known journalists with Hot Press or NME. A few days after the City of Cultural launch, I received a letter from the Lord Mayor, apologetically explaining that the event wasn't open to the public. I had learned a valuable lesson. If you want something badly enough, don't wait for an official invitation.
The colourful Roman festival of Lupercalia, celebrating the coming of spring, is the origin of our Valentine's Day. In order to end its pagan rituals, 5th century Christians combined Lupercalia with the feast day of St. Valentine. But it's Chaucer who's credited with associating Valentine's Day with romance. He linked a tradition of courtly love with Valentine's Day in the 14th century. The main winners in the past century have been Hallmark since they began mass-producing Valentine cards in 1913. However, the card delivered to the student union office of my Belfast college in 1974 was surely romantic enough for even Chaucer to approve of. Bearing a glorious hot pink bouquet of three-dimensional satin roses, it arrived not in an envelope, but in a sturdy cardboard box. When you opened it, a heart popped up and it played the theme tune from Dr. Zhivago. It was much admired, especially when, in my absence, my friend Helena McVeigh pinned it to the main college notice board and wrote a note beside it. Can you beat that with a big stick? While Belfast in the 1970s was grim, that college on the Falls Road was a vibrant place, with the Student Union office at its heart. We created our own entertainment. We put on plays in the Drama Society, went to screenings in the Film Society, and attended lunchtime concerts in which intense young men with side locks and flowing hair sang Dylan and Cohen songs. I lived then in the aptly named Broadway, a street of red brick terraced houses directly opposite the college. Apt because against the daily reality of bombs, gunfire and the screeching of Saracens, with the Beehive pub, a Chipper's and a corner shop all next door, our flat was a social hub, especially on those nights when it was not safe for friends from other parts of the city to travel home. That summer of 74, when my flatmates were heading off on J1 visas to work in America, I chose to ignore the nearby mural which proclaimed, "We will never forsake the blue skies of Ulster for the grey mists of the Irish Republic." Instead, I headed to Dublin to join my real-life Valentine. Having paid our summer rent in advance, we planned to return to the flat in the autumn. After a few weeks in Dublin, I took the train back to Belfast with an empty rucksack to collect some of my clothes. I walked from the train station to Castle Street and got a black taxi up the Falls Road to the flat. But my key would not open the door. Instead, two burly young men opened it from the inside. They looked like hard men not to be messed with, and I was about to turn and run when they greeted me with a friendly, "How's about you?" They explained all of the empty flats in the area had been taken over, and they'd been allocated mine. Now, this 1970s Belfast has recently been brilliantly captured by Anna Burns in her novel Milkman. It was Belfast of her somebody McSomebody, of euphemisms like connected, active, renouncer, and a place of unspoken cues about what could or couldn't be said or done. I opted therefore for the advice given by Colm Sands in his song, "Whatever you say, say nothing." I was reassured that all my stuff was safe, and so it was, neatly packed in cardboard boxes in an unrecognisably clean and tidy front room, with only the student staple, our large Che Guevara poster, still in place above the gas fire. I packed up my rucksack, the new occupants made tea and toast, and we sat together, chatting about this and that. I was getting the hang of this, "Whatever you say, say nothing." Then I remembered my Valentine's card. Had they seen it? They looked at me as if I was crazy. "What? A wee thing like that could be anywhere." "No," I said, "it's huge. My boyfriend in Dublin sent it, so it's really special. I don't want to go back without it." The men looked at each other in exasperation and their faces became tense and stony. There was a few seconds of impasse and I began to think I'd pushed my luck too far. "Let me just tell you where I left it," I ventured, and one of them went off to look. Quickly and sheepishly, he returned, carrying my card. "That's a cracker of a card, all right," he conceded. I opened the box, and when that heart popped up and the music filled the room, I watched their faces relax and their smiles reach their eyes. We were, briefly, just three young people, all with our dreams, before we went our separate ways.
Thank you. a dangerous man. When I was a teenager, I was arrested, tossed from a chip shop into a patrol car between two shelves of men who didn't listen, who listed off crime and evidence, brutal through a mesh of streets in the boiling dark. Everything grew out beyond grasping, the cell and the door whapping, the ribbed ink stain of my fingers. The elementals you remember, a shout in the corridor, a cracked mug of sweet tea, cigarette smoke, cold sweat. At some untellable hour, an outrage of bluster. Through an open door that rolled like a stone and resurrection, into the hall homewards, fretting, savaged, uncoiled, backlit by taxis, loosening step by step, a dangerous man.
Are you dancing? She says. Are you asking? I say. I look down at my brogues, await her answer. My cheeks are burning, heart is beating faster. A beaming smile is spread across my face now. Dare I look up and meet her gaze? I want to. She takes my hand and asks again, "You dancing?" Skin on skin, high voltage sparks ignite. Floating high, I walk onto the dance floor. I take her in my arms, we dance all night. I laid the colours of me at her feet then. She painted me in vivid shades of light. We painted years that followed, spent together, in shades of sunny days and starlit nights. A million songs and dances filled our decades, establishing the soundtrack of our lives. But dancing feet stop dancing when their time comes. My feet, they dance alone through widowed life now. Are you dancing? I say. Are you asking? I say. I hug her dinner dress close to my heart now. I look down at my brogues, secure my footing, I close my eyes and dance with her once more.
Valentine's morning, 1995, and there's a ringing in me head. The ringing will not stop. I keep my eyes closed tight. I'm in student digs. I'm on the top bunk, and the Mayo girl is on the bottom. I know we had a party last night, because when I cough, there's a rawness to me throat that can only come from drinking and singing in a room full of smokers. I keep my eyes closed tight, and still the ringing will not stop. The phone. I open my eyes and thank Jesus that noise is the phone. I thought our single on St. Valentine's party had backfired into an unmerciful ringer of a hangover. It's the phone. I sit up. I feel okay. I look down and notice I'm still wearing my red velvet dress. Well now, that's interesting. I jump off me top bunk and nearly land on a man. He's fully dressed, laid out on our bedroom floor, holding the hand of the Mayo girl on the bottom bunk and cradling an empty bottle of whiskey in his other hand. Happy St. Valentine's Day is right. I climb over Whiskey Man, tiptoe out of the bedroom, stumble down 2 flights of stairs and pick up the phone in the hall. I press button A and say hello. Me da says hello back. Me da. I look down at me red velvet dress and notice there's a ladder in me black tights. I feel a wave of scarlet rush up to me face. Nothing like a morning phone call from your da to make you feel all sorts of guilt about wearing last night's clothes. Are you still on for lighting candles in White Fire Street? Da's voice comes out of the black receiver. I close my eyes again and remember my promise. Meet him at the Carmelites Church and light candles at the shrine to St. Valentine. 2 hours and 1 strong cup of coffee later, I meet the Da in the doorway of the Church of Mount Carmel. We cross the threshold and I take hold of me Da's hand. I know St. Valentine's Day is not only a special day for lovers, but it is also me nanny's anniversary. She died on St. Valentine's Day, 1965. I never met me Da's ma, but the family says I have her bold spirit and cheeky grin. My nanny, Liberty's born and bred, had a great devotion to St. Valentine, and she prayed hard that all her children and grandchildren would find true love. Da brings me over to the shrine of St. Valentine and explains how a priest called Father Spratt went to Rome in the early 1800s on a pilgrimage. He gave a sermon to all the great and the good and came back with St. Valentine's relics and a vial of his blood. Seemingly, Father Spratt had the gift of the gab. I look up at the statue of the saint, dressed in red robes and holding a bright yellow crocus. I like the crocus. It appeals to me more than all the bunches of red roses I saw on my way to the church. I ask me Da, what's the story with the crocus? Da looks at me like the heathen he suspects I am and raises his eyes to St. Valentine. Da explains. The saint gave a letter containing a crocus to the blind daughter of his jailer, and when she opened it, she could see the golden blossom. The saint signed the note, "From your Valentine," and there you have it. We sit in the pews. Da asks me if I got any Valentines in the post. I say no, and begin to feel like the jailer's blind daughter. To make matters worse, last night's fun is beginning to give me a bit of a headache this morning. Da kneels down to pray while I stare at the wooden and silver casket under the marble statue of St. Valentine. I wonder if the patron saint of love's blood is really locked in there. I don't know, but I kneel down beside me Da, just in case. Da prays in a whisper loud enough for me to hear. O glorious advocate, St. Valentine, look with pity upon our daughter Rachel. Hear our request that she stops acting the maggot, and hear our prayers that she finds true love. I start to laugh. We sit back up on the pew. Da elbows me and says, "Come on, you, till I buy you some breakfast." I follow me Da down the aisle, but not before I turn and give the statue of St. Valentine a nod and a wink.
On this morning's programme, we heard Small Talk by Oliver Sears, By Invitation Only by Jackie Linham, Gather Ye Rosebuds by Olive Travers, A Dangerous Man, a poem by Fred Johnston, Are Ye Dancing, a poem by Sarah Shine, and that was recorded at Sunday Miscellany Live at the Red Line Festival in the Civic Theatre in Tallaght, and Valentine's, A Nod and a Wink by Rachel Hegarty. And the music this morning was opening variations on A Vous Dirige Maman or Twinkle Twinkle Little Star by Mozart, played by Olivia Rave on piano. The Hothouse Flowers version of I Can See Clearly Now by Johnny Nash. We heard Lara's theme from Dr. Zhivago, played by André Roux and the Johann Strauss Orchestra. Police and Thieves by Junior Mervyn and See Through Blue by Beth Orton. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.